Right here. Good afternoon. The Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee will now be called to order. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Lupus.
Here.
Vice Chair Fetterhoff.
Here.
Ranking Member Davis.
Here.
Representative Cheney.
Here.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hunchowski.
Here.
Representative Koster.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Learned.
Here.
Representative McCurdy.
Here.
Representative McFarland. Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Nixon.
Here.
Representative Roach.
Present.
Representative Rodriguez.
Present.
Representative Trabulsi.
Here.
Representative Trunau.
Here.
Representative Williams.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you so much, Kirsten. Members, welcome back to our Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee. Just as a matter of housekeeping, please be sure to turn off all of your electronic devices. Make sure to be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters. And please, in this room, as it's a little bit different from some of the other meeting rooms, remember to push the microphone button before you start to speak. Members, today we have one bill on our agenda, our first bill as a committee, and one presentation. And we will begin with HB 3, Home Book Delivery for Elementary Students, by Representative Trabulsi. Representative Trabulsi, you are recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Chair Lupus, and good morning, members. A child's ability to read is critical to his or her success, not only in school, but in life. Assessments from 2018-19 school year showed that 43% of Florida's third grade students were reading below grade level. This is an alarming statistic because 88% of high school students who do not graduate struggle with reading in third grade. In my own district, we have 1,140 third grade students. 88% of that is 1,003. So 88% of those students may not graduate, or they may have difficulty throughout their school career. House Bill 3, the New World's Reading Initiative, provides hard copy books to elementary school students on a monthly basis and resources for their parents to help improve reading performance. I'd like to start with a quote. I believe it's the essence of this bill. Neil deGrasse, "Give a kid a book and you can change the world. In a way, even the universe." This bill requires that the Department of Education or a statewide third-party organization to administer the New World's Reading Initiative. The administrator is responsible for creating an application process for school districts to participate, curating the books to be distributed, coordinating book delivery, and developing digital tools parents may use to help improve their child's reading skills. Participating school districts must work with local nonprofit partners to market and fundraise for the initiative. Participating school districts are also responsible for identifying eligible students, which are those who have substantial reading deficiency or who are reading below grade level on state assessments. Students remain in the initiative until they are promoted to sixth grade or their parent opts out. Under the bill, books must be provided at no cost to families, with funding for the initiative shared equally by the statewide administrator and each participating school districts on a pro-rata basis. And that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Members, are there questions of the bill sponsor? Seeing no, that's my apologies. Ranking Member Davis.
Thank you, Rep. I appreciate your presentation with this bill. The first question I have is, it feels like this program is designed for K through fifth grade at this point. Is there any consideration for extending this program to include VPK or our middle schools and high schools? And I ask that question because we do have a partner that partners with our school district that has included the VPK, middle school, and high school. So great bill, but is there any consideration for that?
Thank you so much, Ranking Member. I appreciate that. I apologize.
You're recognized, Representative.
Thank you so much. So at this time, there is no consideration for that, and I appreciate your question, and I know we've had some conversation over this, and in Duval County, I believe that there is a program that has adopted this. From what I understand, the older children are tutoring, and there are also some wonderful VPK programs, but this is specifically designed for kindergarten through fifth grade at this time.
Do you have a follow-up, Ranking Member? You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Rep, your bill focuses on delivery with some of the school districts. I guess with the school districts, I guess, adding or raising 50% of that. So my question was, could you take us through the process of who's, how the book's being provided?
You're recognized, Representative.
Thank you. Yes, I can certainly do that. So it is a two-fold program where there is a 50% through general revenue that will be provided for half the cost. The other half the cost is through the school district and their partners, nonprofit partners within their district. And this can be your education foundation, it could be your Rotary Club, it could be any nonprofit organization that you partner with to raise those additional dollars. And second part, how will we choose the distributors of the books? We will put a request for bid out. The administrator will do that.
Any further questions, Ranking Member? You're okay. Representative Williams, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You spoke about a split on the first place on the analysis, where you speak of the Department of Education or either a contract third-party entity. How was that third-party entity chosen?
You recognize, Representative.
Thank you so much for that question, Representative. That third-party administrator, if the Department of Education decides to use a third-party administrator, they will choose someone that has best practices in this realm and have already have a model that they can sustain.
Do you have a further question, Representative? Follow-up. You recognize, Representative?
When you say they will choose a partner that they already have engaged into this type of program, or this would be something altogether different?
There are similar programs that have been developed, not on a statewide level and not encompassing everything that HB3 does. However, there are models out there that the Department of Education may feel better to use their expertise in delivering that administration.
And that would be how?
You're recognized, Representative.
That would be how that third-party contract is chosen.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Learned, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I represent, first of all, making sure that kids get books, these, especially the kids who are struggling with reading, it's a wonderful, commendable action I think you're trying to take here, so thank you. My question is about the opt-in, opt-out process for the school district. I represent Hillsborough County because of the pandemic. I'm sure everybody here is dealing with the same budget struggles in their home districts. I just want to ask you, what does it take for the school district to opt in? Is it true that they can opt in or opt out after they've already opted in down the road if they are facing financial trouble meeting their 50% threshold?
Thank you for that question, Representative. Yes, absolutely. So they opt in easily with a very simple application, and they can opt out anytime they choose, and it will not be in perpetuity.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yep, you're recognized.
Thank you. And also, from my experience running a tutoring center, one of the things I've always learned with kids with disabilities that are struggling the most are tend to lack some of the parental involvement. The books can't read themselves, right? So I'm just curious what thought process, research, any conversations you've had in the development of this bill that came up to how we target the people who need it the most within that group that is struggling with their reading.
Thank you, Representative.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So the way that they'll be identified overall, kindergarten, first and kindergarten, first, and second grade, these children will be identified through teachers and counselors, third grade FSA, fourth and fifth grade, through benchmark testing. Additionally, to identify the children that need it most, anybody that's reading under grade level needs it most. And you'd asked a question about parental engagement. Part of this bill does encompass parental engagement, and it's not anything that is cumbersome to the parent that's going to take a long time. It could include text messaging, short videos, but it is a way to engage the family in a simple and relatively short time.
Good. Representative Nixon, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Learn asked two of my questions, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Rep. As we had a great discussion the other day, just being the mother of a child who was struggling with reading and then she became an author, I just know the importance of reading and books, right? So I do have a question because a part of the issue, I think, with my daughter and some other kids that I have had the opportunity to mentor and tutor as well is just in regards to diversity and just wanting to know as it relates to the books that are going to be offered, how is that going to be done? Do the students get to choose books? And then my focus, I really want to know, like, are there going to be diverse books with diverse authors and, you know, just stories and characters that kids of color, right, can see and read about as well?
You recognize Representative.
Thank you, Representative. And I've really enjoyed talking to you too as well. I was really impressed that you and your daughter wrote a book together, and I love that you are a champion of reading. So I applaud you for that. I hold you in high regard for that. As far as diversity is concerned and book selection, absolutely. So the books will be, the child can actually have participate in that and choose the genre that appeals to them most because we want them to be excited about learning. And also the different diversity of books. Yes, there will be a multitude of diversity in the books, but mostly relating to what is appropriate to the age and to the child on their reading level. Additionally, not part of HB3, as you heard this week, hopefully, we have a reading IQ where any child in the state of Florida can enter that library online at no cost and access 5,500 books at their fingertips. And there, again, are just a multitude of genres and topics there.
Any further questions, Representative? Okay. Any further questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we are now going to move into public testimony. Our first appearance card is for Mr. David Sardar from Fruitland Park. Is Mr. Sardar here? Okay. Okay, well, we're waiting for Mr. Sardar. Christopher Dudley, representing Florida State Alliance of YMCA, waves in support. Edward Briggs from the Helios Education Foundation, waving in support. And Edward Briggs again for RCMA, waving in support. And we will wait one moment to see if Mr. Sardar will be joining us. Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and move forward in the interest of—
Chair, while we're waiting, I just need to ask her one other question. Possible.
I'm going to go. Okay, we'll go back into questions. Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Okay, in today's society, we have a lot of parents that work 3 to 4 different jobs, and some of them are struggling themselves. Do we have anything in place that will assist them if I'm a parent and I can't read? How will I be able to help my child?
Great question.
You're recognized, Representative.
Still learning the rules, Chair. Yes, thank you. That's a great question, Representative. So I can answer that in twofold. Again, there will be text messaging, but to your point, parents that cannot read, there will also be video instructions for parents, short form, very simple. Also for our digital divide, even though you didn't answer this question, for our digital divide families, there will be take at home materials for them.
Thank you, Representative. Members, going back into public testimony, Mr. David Sardar.
David Sirdar, Fruitland Park, Florida, Lake County, but I'm parked at Sumner County because I go to school board meetings there. I go to school board meetings in Lake County. I've been to school board meetings in Brevard. And children, I know some parents don't want their kids to go to school right now because of the COVID. One gentleman in my neighborhood, he goes to Leesburg High School, where I used to work. I had, in one of the committee meetings at the Senate, I was wearing a Leesburg shirt because somebody left it. I don't drink.
Mr. Sirdar, please keep it to the...
Well, I want you to know, I agree, you got to help out with the students that are at home. My father was a elementary school principal. He still got letters from doctors and lawyers that he helped out in the black neighborhoods of North Chicago, because I got to represent my grandma Caldwell's 100th birthday party. She and Mrs. Caldwell ran my dad's lunch program. I got them flowers. I am a florist. I'm worried about our kids' future. And you have a big job to take care of. Education, you know, for post-secondary, you know, it's so important. I know my dad, 91 years old, with 36 years of the same school he went to as a child. Well, right in Bay County, we have a Mrs. Cunningham, who just got on the school board, a sister. She was an elementary school teacher, principal. And, well, you are the leaders that got elected. You are the officials. You are the gladiators. You know what you're doing. I agree. Helping out the students that are at home, the parents. You know, a lot of people are scared because of the COVID. I know this. I go to a lot of churches. They got to lock them up.
Mr. Sirdar, please bring this in for a landing.
Well, wars are fought with weapons. Well, I'm worried about it. You know, keep our paradise clean. I got this from Bakari Burns. I work with the mayor of Orlando. I work with Jerry Emmons. I've got their pins. I am honored to be in front of many people, public comedy.
Thank you, Mr. Schools, thank you, Mr.
Our
Star.
Children, my son is the most important person to me. Who doesn't love their kids?
Thank you so much, sir. All right, members, we are now moving into debate. Is there debate on the bill? Ranking Member Davis. Representative Hochowski.
Thank you very much, Chair. Rep. Tobolsky, I just wanted to let you know how great I think this bill is. I wanted to also let everybody know that Broward County Public Schools sent us a letter supporting HB3 because they it will also complement their existing program of delivery of books. I also appreciate that there is a local decision-making component regarding participation. As somebody who used to be on the local level, that's very important. And I look forward to many children who are struggling with reading, feeling seen and noticed when they get their books coming to their homes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hawkins, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As somebody that's a president of an education foundation, I want to tell you I welcome this bill to work with our school district to make this happen. We had a great program up until COVID to help struggling third graders, and I think this is going to work out nicely for the students. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Any further debate, members? All right, seeing no debate, Representative Tribolsi, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, members, for taking the time to be excited about this bill. And I'm going to close with a short story on why and one of the reasons why this bill is so important to me. I remember as a child, every month, my parents subscribed. You're probably not all old enough to remember this, but my parents subscribed to a little magazine called Highlights for me. And it was so exciting to get something in the mail, first of all. And it was so exciting that it was for me. And then all month long, I was able to read the stories and do the puzzles. And I went back over and over again. And what that did, which I didn't know at the time, but of course in retrospect, but what that did was got me excited about reading. And again, in the essence of this bill, we certainly want our children to read on grade level. We want them to be successful students and adults. But more importantly, we want them to be excited about reading and the world in front of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Members, just for the record, please turn on your microphones when you vote. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Representatives Cheney.
Yes.
Davis.
Yes.
Fetterhoff.
Yes.
Hawkins.
Yes.
Hanshofsky.
Yes.
Koster.
Yes.
LaMarca.
Yes.
Learned.
Yes.
McCurdy.
Yes.
McFarland.
Yes.
Mooney.
Yes.
Nixon.
Yes.
Roach.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Trabulsi.
Yes.
Trunau.
Yes.
Williams.
Yes.
Chiralupis.
Yes.
18 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Members, by your vote, HB 3 will be reported favorably. Representative Trabulsi, congratulations.
Thank you.
So members, now we're going to move into the presentation portion of our committee meeting. We have a presentation from the Office of Early Learning on financial and academic supports provided to families, students, and early learning providers under the CARES Act. Our presenter is Dr. Eric Hall, who is a senior chancellor for the Department of Education. Dr. Hall, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you and also Vice Chair Fetterhoff for your continued support and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you today, and as mentioned, my name is Eric Hall, and I serve as the Senior Chancellor at the Florida Department of Education, and also stand before you today as a parent, like many of you, that understand the critical importance that early learning and supports play for our children. And I also want to thank you, you know, Chiralupis, because I know not only your leadership in this role, but your continued passion in this work, you know, for a long period of time. Just again, appreciate what you've done for the, you know, the children of Florida and for our system all across the state. So again, it's a pleasure to be with you today. And I want to talk a little bit about the work that we've been doing to really support our early learning system, particularly in this period of time with the pandemic. And we'll focus more so on the CARES Act, but I want to set the stage, because if we talk about our early learning system, when we talk about those early building blocks of our entire education continuum, it starts in our early learning provider networks. It starts with our educators. It starts with the networks that are out there that represent small business, our public schools, our charter schools, and everybody collectively that's serving, again, our youngest learners here in the state. And if you've heard our commissioner speak, oftentimes you will hear reference to Frederick Douglass. You'll hear, you know, several comments about the work that he has championed and how that, you know, that access to a high-quality education, you know, it leads to freedom, it leads to liberty, and the uplifting of the soul. With that, though, he also has another quote, and I want to reference this because as we talk about children, we know that it is easier, and these are his words, it is easier to build strong children than it is to repair broken adults. And so if we start with that premise and we stay focused on how we support that foundation and what we need to do to ensure the success of our children long-term, again, it starts here. And I appreciate this committee, you know, not only hearing this conversation today, but the work that you're going to do in this session and the work that we have ahead of us, and also recognizing the tremendous work that's been done across our system for years. And again, it's built on the backbone of small businesses and educators and leaders that are ensuring the success of our children and our youngest learners all across Florida. If there's nothing else that you take away from today's conversation, I want to plant one seed with you. And I'll talk about this more as I get into some of the data and trends that we've seen across the state. When we think about early learning, again, that foundation that's being created to have students ready for kindergarten, the supports that go into place for social emotional development, the brain development, everything that again creates that foundation for learning, we know that again, if you take nothing else from today's conversation, when we look at data and trends, that if we do not have students ready by third grade, then we truly risk, we're at significant risk of losing them for a lifetime. But it starts with what we're doing in our early learning centers and the educators that are in those spaces serving, again, our youngest learners here in Florida. I go back to when we, you know, look back on March. And March 13th was a day when not just, you know, Florida, the entire nation was looking at what we were going to do in the area of education. So we had to approach that work and looking at what the data, the trends, everything that was, you know, really taking place, not just here in our nation, but around the globe. And as we look at the pandemic and we looked at what we were really trying to study and evaluate, and we made that pivot on March 13th, to me, that was a significant shift that set Florida apart from the get-go from the rest of the nation. As school facilities across our country were closing their doors, as we saw schools that were shutting down and kids were not engaged in learning any longer, whether it was in our early learning system with childcare or whether it was in our K-12 system, we were diligent on March 13th about making a pivot. And I remember very clearly sitting in a conference room with our commissioner and being engaged in conversations with educational leaders of all levels of our system, talking about where we were going to go and what we were going to do. because we weren't going to stop education. We were going to make a pivot and a shift from brick and mortar schools to distance learning. And I think it's important to call out that a large number of our child care centers, they did not close their doors. Those dedicated educators and leaders, they stood in place and they did what they needed to do to ensure that parents and families had access to child care and, again, to continue to support that early learning system. And I'm going to dive into that. But collectively, everything that we were learning at that point in time really helped to frame what we consider to be our theory of action. We knew that if we were going to do what was best for kids and make sure that we did not lose the ground that we have made over the years in closing gaps, whether it was access gaps, opportunity gaps, or in many cases when we talk about the achievement gap. If we were not going to lose that ground, we had to make sure that we were going to go forward knowing that we were going to reopen schools and our early learning centers. We knew that with schools being open and programs, we had to do it with a moral purpose to stay focused on those gaps. Florida has been a national leader in doing a lot of this work with the gaps that we've closed, but we can't afford to lose ground in the midst of a pandemic. You've probably heard us say this over and over, that the gaps that have potentially been exacerbated during this period of time, we've been intentional about how we've addressed not only the CARES Act funding in our early learning system, our K-12 system, and our post-secondary. We did it with tremendous intentionality. And I'll highlight that in just a minute so that we understand that, again, our early learning system, which creates that early foundation, we couldn't set that apart from everything else that we were going to do. And we knew that we could only hit our stride economically by ensuring that programs were going to be open, centers would be open, our schools would be open, to not only provide that safe, nurturing environment for kids, but to ensure that parents felt that they had the confidence in place for their children to be in a safe, healthy environment during this period of time. And then taking a dimmer switch approach. It was about taking steps. It wasn't about flipping the switch and saying, hey, let's get everybody back in. It was about, let's use the research. Let's use the information that we had available to work with our educators, work with our coalitions, our providers, our K-12 system. How do we take that information and data and make good, informed decisions to do what we're doing today? If you look across the country, there are states out there still having conversations about how to reopen their doors and provide services and supports for kids. You go back into the summer, and when we launched our CARES Act plan, which set the stage for the work ahead, and when we issued our Emergency Order 6 and Emergency Order 7 about how to make sure that we gave parents options for the types of educational services that their children needed, those are the things that, again, we have remained focused on and have been very intentional about from the get-go. And you also hear the commissioner say this over and over. And I remember it clearly, again, back in March when we had these conversations with leaders. Anything and everything that we're going to do, we have tough challenges ahead. We knew that we had decisions that we would have to make. But if we do it with compassion and grace and we do it with a focus on serving those that we're tasked with serving, we will make unbelievable things happen. And I think that's the kind of data and trends that we're seeing, knowing that, again, while we're ahead, we cannot allow good to be good enough when better is expected and we have much work to do still. When it comes to supporting and sustaining our early learning system, some of the things that we knew, again, from the early beginnings, and I want to recognize the leadership of our executive director for the Office of Early Learning, Shan Goff. Her and her team have worked tirelessly with our coalitions, really trying to analyze and look at the things that we needed to do to make strategic investments in supporting our providers. We knew that we had to not only stabilize the existing systems that were out there and the programs, but we also knew we had to take steps to reopen those that had to close. Those were tough decisions. They were tough things that local businesses, schools, and districts, everybody was trying to navigate. But we also knew that we had to remain focused on our most vulnerable children in the state. We had to look at those families and those children from low-income homes that we had to ensure access. We had to look at how did we ensure that school readiness was in place to serve the families that needed that support so that families could go to work and do the things that they needed to support their households. But again, making sure that they felt comfortable, confident, and safe, that their children would be in a safe and healthy environment. We had to look at the gaps. You're going to hear me say that quite a bit throughout this because it's not just in our K-12 system. If we're talking about having children ready for kindergarten when they enter on the first day, if we're talking about how do we make sure that students understand access to vocabulary and the meaning of words, those early foundational skills, those are the things that we had to drive home and make sure we didn't lose during this period of time, which sets the stage for how we address gaps when students enter our K-12 system. And then looking at how do we redirect existing resources. One of the roles that I serve also is I serve as the chair for our state advisory council for the PDG grant, which is the preschool development grant, which is a 3-year grant to help us work with coalitions and collaborate with multiple agencies to see how do we continue to support and build out supports and strategies to strengthen our early learning system. And so with that grant and being involved in many stakeholders, we had to say, okay, where do we have the opportunity where appropriate to reprioritize some of those funds? Provide coalitions with local flexibility, because while we may know the funding and the policy and the things that we need to do here at the state level, We had to create the conditions locally with coalitions to be responsive to local community needs. And then enhance the workforce through incentives. When we think about, you know, driving quality, and quality has to be front and center on this. In order to prepare our children, quality had to be at the key. And that means also, what are we doing to support our educators working in our early learning system and building their capacity and continuing to build their skills during this period of time? And you'll see where some of the funding and strategies that we have used through our CARES Act have been focused on doing that. To give you a high-level overview of the CARES Act, and you'll hear me talk about CARES Act 1 funding, and then, of course, we're right now in the midst of, you know, getting to work through CARES Act 2. But in this first phase of funding, you'll hear four, you know, primary categories. First category that you'll see up here is the almost $173.5 million, that is the governor's education, emergency education relief fund. Oftentimes, you'll hear the term GEAR funds. Those are funds that the governor was able to prioritize, and we were very fortunate as a state that working hand-in-hand with the governor's vision to ensure that we are doing the things we need to support children, we were able to leverage both the GEAR funds in conjunction with the funds in these other categories, like the K-12 fund, which was $770 million in this first round, going out to our districts and to our K-12 schools. We had about almost $874 million going out to our post-secondary institutions, which was our state colleges, our universities, private colleges and universities, as well as our 48 state and technical colleges. And then the one that we're going to talk about today is the $223.6 million that was in this first round of CARES Act funding that, again, we have strategically aligned with the other priorities that you've seen above from a funding standpoint. And I'll walk us through, again, how we're using those funds to really reinforce how do we support and sustain a system to ensure that access that has been critical to our families. With the CARES Act funding and the $223 million that I just referenced for childcare, I'll point you to the last three bullets, and let's talk about what those funds primarily could be used for. And again, this was administered through our Office of Early Learning. Looking at how we continue to provide support to parents and to providers so that payments could be made for childcare. Looking at how did we also support those providers that were closed to reopen. Looking at how do we provide support to our emergency and healthcare workers. At that point in time, we had to make sure that of all things that were happening in the midst of the pandemic, how do we make sure that healthcare workers and our frontline workers and those that were really involved in being first responders, how do we make sure that they had access to childcare so that they could provide those critical services? And that was a part of the work that we did through our CARES Act plan, which is reinforced in the federal, and kind of the federal guidance and that was allowable for these funds. And then supporting providers with a lot of the things that we've continued to hear about, basics around cleaning, sanitation, so that the environments themselves were you know, available and in a good, safe, and health environment for our children and our staff. And then I come back to this goal around achievement. I showed you those four big buckets of funding, and I want to drive home the point that, you know, the commissioner has said this, we've been talking about this, we have to continue to focus on driving grade-level achievement. We have to look at right now, we have a goal of 90%, and I appreciate the bill that was mentioned earlier about access to books and looking at the work that we can do to continue to drive all these strategies that we know have good support behind them to drive grade level reading. But in order to get this goal at 90%, we have a lot of work to do. And it starts in our early learning system. We've made this our North Star, and you can tell by the way that we have really woven together the multiple funding sources throughout our CARES Act plan, which I would tell you if you wanted to get a copy of that, we can make sure that that's made available. But it is a well over 100 slides of a PowerPoint that walks through every step that we had taken to think critically through the research, the evidence, and also the strategies that we had to use to invest funds that were going to build the capacity of all sectors of our education system so that collectively we were taking care of children in the early learning system while creating the conditions in our post-secondary and our workforce training programs to help people get back to work, get the skills and the credentials that are needed that are going to lead to long-term upward mobility. And being able to do that in a way that keeps all of these things very cohesive. We didn't start to allocate funds and say, okay, you know, early learning, here's your bucket. Do your own thing. We didn't say K-12, here's your bucket, do your own thing. State colleges and workforce education. Yes, those funds are dedicated in that direction, but in the end, we sat down collectively and said, we've got to have a single vision that goes from the beginning of our system to the back end of our system to ensure that we've got supports for families, and again, creating those conditions for the success through the skills that are needed to really get back into work, and again, have the safe and healthy environment for our families, for their children, to be able to have that peace of mind and continue their education, training, and get back into work, especially in areas that we know were impacted heavily during this period of time where business and industry had significant shifts. Those are the things that collectively with our CARES Act dollars that we have been intentional, and again, I think we can be proud about where we've been, and We still have much work to do and very grateful to look at this next phase of the CARES funding that we'll be rolling out here very soon with a strategy. As I talked about the goal on 90%, and you heard me start with this about one of the things that I'm really hoping you will take away, and it's that impact and that importance around third grade. We have trend data now where we can go back and look. And if we look at third graders back in 2011 and 12 that were taking our state exam, the FCAT 2.0, we go back and we look at students that were performing at that point in time, and we fast forward to when they hit the 10th grade. What we know is that students that were scoring at a level one and level two on that assessment, you get to 10th grade, only 14% move beyond that level one, level two. If you look at the numbers, 9% for African-American students and 12% for our low-income students. So that urgency is real. And when we talk about this, and I'm telling you, as someone who's been a former educator, who spent most of my career working directly with kids, working in schools, doing this work, we can create the conditions for success, but we have to say we're going to double down in this point in time, use our early learning system as the backbone and the support to create those conditions early on for the success that's going to have kids ready for kindergarten. And again, work with our teachers, our school leaders, our districts, everyone collectively, to get us to the point to where we change this narrative. Nationally, as states are navigating right now, how do they react to this situation? How do they respond? What we're saying is that we are not going to lose the ground. We have tried to be intentional about this. And I think, again, we can be proud about where we stand. Again, much work has been done, and there's much more work to do. But this narrative, we cannot lose sight of this. And it's not just a K-12 discussion. K-12 is where we see the side effects and the implications of what has happened. But if we drill down into our early learning system and we support our providers, our programs, and those that are supporting and caring for our children, this narrative can be changed. And it will be changed, but it's going to take tough work and tough decisions. And we appreciate the leadership of this committee, the legislature, our governor, the commissioner, our state board, collectively coming together around this conversation to be our partners and thinking through these strategies and the plans as we go forward. So some of the immediate actions. Now I'm going to pivot right back into the funding and talk about how we had to deliver and really deploy services. When we made that pivot back in March and into April, the CARES Act funding, we knew there was going to be some resources. We didn't know all the details yet. We were starting to work through what would these plans ultimately look like. So we had to say, what are we doing with our existing resources to leverage and support our system? So you'll see that we had $153 million in the Child Care Development Fund that we were able to redeploy to help support our early learning system. Some of that was looking at how did we do things like waiving required co-payments for families? How did we look at providing, you know, support for things like attendance and enrollment? Waiving, you know, in some of our early, you know, initial emergency order number one and emergency order number two, creating some of those conditions and flexibilities so that, again, parents could be taken care of when we talked about waiving required co-payments, but we also took care of our providers to make sure that what was happening is that they could be paid based on enrollment versus attendance, especially as families may not have been sending their children every single day to the providers or were maybe trying to figure out in their own home what were the conditions they had to consider. But we did not want to see families lose access to these services or to these programs. So we used existing funds and we were able to reallocate and prioritize those efforts. The $84.4 million, that was specific to VPK, and how did we support VPK families that in many cases, you know, come March, if they were transitioning out or attendance became a barrier because many of our district providers and others that had transitioned and the facilities themselves may not have been open, we had to work through that. But again, we could not completely dismantle our early learning system by not taking care of those challenges and waiting for the CARES Act dollars to be deployed. These were the early stages that we took. And then $5.2 million for the preschool development grant. We were able to deploy those resources out to the coalitions to help support with things like trauma-informed training for providers and for families, being able to get that out to the coalition so that they could make those decisions locally with those supports, being able to also support school readiness with curriculum and use those tools to, again, continue to build the capacity and the training for our educators, because you remember earlier we talked about how do we continue the development of our educators in the early learning system. As we moved into the CARES Act plan, this is where we start to break down the $223.6 million. We spent, you know, basically the first $91 million to support our first responders and emergency healthcare workers. I remember very clearly in some of our communities across the state where schools had been closed, families needed to get back to work. We knew that there was healthcare workers that needed to be out there. We were concerned, like everybody else in the nation, about what would be some of the potential implications. But if we couldn't have our healthcare workers in place and ready to serve and support, we knew that was going to be a challenge. So we were able to step forward, reinforce these resources by being able to work with the hospital association, working with the coalitions, setting up a referral process that would allow, again, our front, you know, first responders and frontline workers in our healthcare system to be able to access that as a resource and a service during this time. Then we moved into the first phase of really deploying investments out through the CARES Act to our providers. You'll see in this first one, $52.8 million that went out as emergency care relief. This was about supporting, you know, infrastructure. We knew that providers were going through a number of challenges with different costs that they were incurring, especially if you're a provider where you have private pay families and school readiness and VPK. Those are all, you know, models with small businesses that they have to figure out how to manage. So these grants were there to help them support infrastructure, continue to support staff and bonuses for retention so that we didn't see our educator workforce not come in and support and serve in our early learning system. And then, of course, going back to the cleaning and the support to ensure that safe and healthy environment. When we moved into that next round, same thing. We were able to put this out there with, you know, with that same intention. So during each of these phases, it was about getting dollars out so that the providers had the resources they needed to take care of infrastructure, staffing needs, and continue to support the cleaning and sanitation of the facilities. We move into the next phase, which is, you know, $16.9 million in phase three. Here we had about 3,100 providers that had been closed in April, but had reopened by August. We knew that, again, there were, you know, and I'll show you the numbers in just a minute about, I think, what I think is a real success story in Florida. When we look at the number of providers that were open back in April serving families, and the number that reopened between April and August, and then up until October, each of these phases was about helping facilities get reopened to provide services. So in this phase, this phase three, when we look at, you know, those programs that are those providers that were closed from April 30th to August 30th, which included some of our public schools and our charter schools who are also providing VPK services, being able to get them to the point of serving families and having them reopen during that time, these funds helped to create those conditions for that kind of success. And then the $19.8 million, which was really the last phase, the phase four, this was to over 11,000 providers. And getting those funds out so that providers that, at least by October 15th, if they were open, this would help to sustain and help them carry some of those challenges that financially they were being impacted because of either, you know, cleaning, sanitation, staffing, all the different hurdles and things that we've been hearing. I would tell you that we've, you know, been very engaged. I know that Executive Director Goff has been on regular calls throughout this process, webinars, working with the coalitions, sending out communications and trying to make sure that, again, we stay connected to where we have, you know, certain efforts or strategies we may need to be prepared to respond to. And I think because of those communications, I think collectively, that's why we've seen some of the achievements that we've seen so far in our early learning system. Beyond the mini grants out to the providers to, again, support those things that we've already talked about, we put $10.9 million. We had many children back in March and April that maybe did not have the option to complete their VPK program. Knowing that, we wanted to make sure that we worked to create the opportunity through almost $11 million that was able to go out to support a kindergarten readiness program for kids that were rising kindergartners so that they would be able to, you know, close any potential gaps or have that readiness when they hit the classroom on the first day of kindergarten. In this case, we had 37 districts that applied and participated. We had some districts that were able to move directly in the summer and start that program. We had some had to navigate local conditions and things like that, and were able to extend some of these programs into the fall to continue to get kindergarten students prepared for what they were, you know, expected to learn when they hit the classroom. And then this next bullet with the progress monitoring. And this is something that I think is really, you know, is going to be a cornerstone to the work that we've done both in our VPK programs, but also in our K-12 system. In the absence of achievement data last spring, you know, we didn't have end-of-year testing. We didn't have some of those assessments in place when programs had to make the pivot. Considering that, we were able to really, I think, build off of some conversations even last year where how do we start to look at how do we assess the growth of children in our VPK programs? Learning from that work, and I want to recognize, you know, Representative Grawl and her leadership as well in thinking about what do we need to do to continue to build capacity within our early learning system and look at how we collect data and use data. In this case, we were able to go off of an assessment that we have in kindergarten It's called the Flickers oftentimes, and it's called the STAR Early Literacy Assessment. That's given in the first 30 days of kindergarten to see how students are prepared for kindergarten readiness. We were able to take that same assessment and through this pilot, bridge that backwards and use that same assessment in VPK as part of a pilot to see how we're monitoring the progress of our children in our VPK programs to be prepared when they take that assessment at the beginning of kindergarten. So this two-year pilot, right now, we have over 1,500 VPK providers that are participating with almost 48,000 children that are participating in this pilot. And what we hope to learn and gain from this is what things can we, one, evaluate and assess for our children and where they are with their growth and their gains during this time, but also how does that really lean itself into the work that our K-12 system is doing as well with progress monitoring. We've done the same thing in K-12 where we have a $10 million investment this year from CARES dollars to help support our K-12 system with using progress monitoring and collecting that data in ways that helps to inform the work that we need to do to support teachers and also support our school leaders and districts and how they deploy resources to support schools during this time. I go back to some of the points that were made earlier. When we made that shift back in March and we used existing resources, we created flexibilities. We tried to make sure that families were supported during this time so that they did not lose access to the school readiness services that they were, eligible and afforded through our state's programs. We wanted to make sure that we created flexibility with timelines. We wanted to make sure that, again, parent co-payments during this time. All of these things collectively, using existing resources, using waiver and flexibility in policy, those are the conditions that I think, when we talk about the outcomes, and you've heard me reference it a few times, is we go back into April when we made that pivot, and we had at that point in time, roughly 58% of our providers closed. And while that is a hard number, I want to celebrate the 42% that remained open. Because again, they stood in place to make sure that families, again, between the educators and the providers, they stood in place to make sure that families had access. But I think the different phases that we have deployed, again, Executive Director, Goff and her team, working with our team at the department, these investments and these strategies along the way, I think have helped us get to the point to where we have now over 98% of our providers open and available to provide services and supports to families in childcare. Now, because we have 98%, I know that doesn't mean that all programs are at full capacity. I want to point that out. There is a difference between having providers open and providers at full capacity. That is where we have to continue to look at how we support our providers during this time as families start to make the decisions they're going to make about having their kids back in programs. But if you don't support the access, then the availability and being able to get parents there is a very different narrative. I think what we've done is we've been able to see our providers and our coalition step up to ensure that, again, 98% of that capacity is there and available. And now we have to work to see what do the trends going forward look like and how do we start to think about this next round of CARES Act funding that will continue to build on this success and look at the shifts and the pivots that we might see in our system in the months ahead. We go back to kindergarten readiness. By having the providers open, having this access, the strategies around, the Rising Kindergarten program, looking at what we've done across our system. Many of you may recall, and I remember this about a year and a half ago when we started to see the outcomes and the trends that were continuing on our kindergarten readiness. To have 53%, meaning that we've got, 47% of our children in kindergarten not ready. You can't change that narrative or that trajectory I talked about in third grade if we're already starting at that point during the first 30 days of school on these assessments. If kindergarten kids coming in are not ready to close those gaps, we can do it. Our teachers are doing it on a regular basis. They're working hard. But again, if we want to change the narrative, the more we can do in our early learning system, the quality, the access, and being able to put those conditions in place for emergent literacy and other trainings that, again, our team has been focused on with our early learners during our early learning educators during this time, collectively, those conditions will help us to continue to frame this narrative and move these numbers in a different direction. And you can see the outcomes between our VPK completers and our VPK non-completers. So we know that, again, going through a quality VPK program, it helps to change that narrative. It changes that trajectory. So we got to continue to look at how we build that capacity and reinforce that capacity as we go forward. This gives you a map of the state. And what you'll see on here is that we have 9 districts across the state that have 60% and above in kindergarten readiness. And I'll point out, there's 9 on here, and I'll just tell you which ones they are because you may not be able to see it clearly on here. But the 9 that we have are Jackson, Liberty, Baker, St. John's, which is actually our highest at 72%, Levy, Seminole, Brevard, Pinellas, and Hendry. The others are falling under that threshold at 59% or under. I mentioned earlier when I showed you the four buckets of funding, and we've talked about the $223 million and how that has been strategically deployed to support our system to get to that point of the 98%, over 98% of our providers being open. When we bridge, and this is, again, I would say that this is probably one of the most comprehensive strategies in the country. And I say that because I talk with other states and we watch the research, we look at the trends. But when we sat down, and again, collectively as a team, and designed our CARES Act plan, looking at the money that was going to be invested in our early learning system, looking at how we build that bridge between early learning and K-12, with, again, that focus on closing gaps. And then what are we doing to build the workforce and create these opportunities, again, for upward mobility for our families by getting credentials of value and being able to help families get back into work with rapid credentials and other resources that we have, again, been intentional about deploying throughout this process. These items here are where we made our decisions with our K-12 funding. And this was funded out of the 10% set aside that the state could use. There were $770 million for K-12. 10% of that was able to be set aside. This in conjunction with funds of the governor's emergency education relief. These were all funds that were going back out to support the system. These weren't funds that were held at the State Department. These weren't funds for anything else other than building capacity of the system. And so whether it was building capacity in early learning, K-12, post-secondary, these things collectively, I think, created a seamless vision. And I think breaking down those silos and making sure that we are staying focused on families and children collectively in our strategy for investment and support, that goes back to the words I've been using over and over. It creates the conditions for long-term success. And it's going to help place Florida on a path that exceeds every other state because we said in this point in time, again, we're going to stand here, we're going to move forward, we cannot lose ground. In fact, we have to accelerate and be able to move at a rate that's going to change those conditions for the long term. Some things I will just highlight on here. As we talk about the reading goal, getting to the 90%, having students kindergarten ready, and what's happening when students are in kindergarten if they're not, ready, we try to make sure that we put supports in place with training our early, grade-level teachers in elementary with, science-based literacy strategies, looking at what we were doing to build the capacity of reading coaches, access to high-quality curriculum. You may recall this past year, we adopted, a complete new set of standards called the BEST standards, Benchmarks for Excellent Student Thinking. Those new state standards, the first phase of that will start to roll out next fall. We have to look at, again, how are we taking these steps to continue to build this narrative that's going to lead to that long-term achievement goal that we have with the 90%. We didn't do these things, again, in an isolated way. We did this hand-in-hand with our superintendents. I know the calls that, Executive Director Goff and her team have had with coalitions, the engagement, the work that's taken place. Again, considering the circumstances and what the rest of the world has been going through, I think, again, Florida is a success story. I think we're going to continue to build on that success. And I just appreciate the opportunity. Chair Lucas, I want to thank you for the ability and the opportunity to be here with you today, the committee, and again, for the continued leadership. But I will end with that same point that I started at the beginning. If we want to change the trajectory and we want to do things that are going to set apart, the one thing I say, we have to do everything we can, early learning up to grade 3. We've got to get that right. If we're going to change the trajectory for kids, we get this right, the course of Florida's future and for our families, and again, the opportunity to create that upward mobility for all families in our state, it starts with that work. And again, we've done great things, but we still have a lot to do, especially coming out of this pandemic, which Florida will definitely be leaders in that space. So, Chair Lucas, I appreciate the opportunity. I'll yield for questions, sir.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chancellor Hall, for your presentation. Members, do you have questions for the Chancellor? Representative Fetterhoff, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So I want to better understand what the department's goal is and was for distributing CARES Act dollars. At times, it appears the department was solely focused on child care that would get parents back to work, which I understand as we are in an economic crisis due to the pandemic. At other times during today's presentation, it seems the department was using the dollars to prop up programs, progress monitoring, workforce, that I would think were already in place and funded. Will you please clarify what the goal is? Because as I understand it, we still disperse, and how does that goal help students progress academically?
You recognize, Chancellor.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that question, and I think if I can provide clarity in maybe two buckets. When we started to make the initial shift in the transitions that we had to last spring, we had two primary focus. One was how do we ensure safety and health? And then the other was how are we going to make sure that we create the conditions to really address gaps? And so when we looked at the early learning, and I'll stay focused on that for the first part of my response, in the child care funding, that $223.6 million, that was focused on a few things. One, support those child care centers, those providers that remained open, who were struggling because, again, either students not coming back in, whether it was students that were not showing up in our BPK programs, whether it was families, you know, maybe those kids were not coming back in because of the fact that families were having to make decisions about circumstances in their own home regarding safety and health. So we had to make sure that we supported them, and that's where the first few investments were targeted on supporting providers that remained open to continue to serve families. That, in conjunction with how we were incentivizing and supporting providers to take care and address the needs of our healthcare workers and our first responders so that our health system could remain open to take care of the crisis and the pandemic. That's the first phase. As you moved into the additional phases, it was about how do you get those providers that were closed as of April 30th? How did we work with them between April 30th and August 30th to be able to get them to reopen so that we could expand capacity of the system? So I think, you know, to your question, Representative, I think it was about support and sustain those aspects of our system that was open and serving, help support them to remain open, and then build the capacity of those that were closed to reopen so that we could serve more families and at the same time help families get back to work, but also ensure that we were getting our children into high-quality childcare, into the supports that they needed. That was a real critical piece, definitely across the board, in what we were doing with the 223, as well as the, you know, the funds that were invested before CARES Act dollars with the flexibilities so that the system would not completely, you know, be dismantled or not be there and available to reopen to serve families as we continue to reopen the economy at that point in time.
You're recognized for follow-up?
This is actually something that came up in our PK Appropriations Committee, which was the 90,000 students that seem to have fallen off the radar in our schools. And I'm wondering if we don't have some connection with looking at our VPK and transferring it to our kindergartners and making sure that those kids are actually going into the kindergarten system. It seems like the 90,000, a lot of that consists of probably kindergartners that parents don't feel comfortable with putting them in the schools yet. So I would like to try to see how we can coordinate that and figure out, I mean, we want to know where those 90,000 students are and what we can do to figure that out.
You recognize, Chancellor.
Yes, sir. I think the point that you bring up, Representative Fedoroff, is that that is a critical element. As a matter of fact, when we started to look at those trends early on, and we saw that in the first half of the year with some of the trends around kindergarten enrollment, and of course, you know, with, you know, compulsory education requirements and attendance requirements, kindergarten, we did see a little bit of that trend. But because we recognized that, and we also looked at some of the trends with BPK, we moved quickly into our next emergency order, which was emergency order number 7 that we issued back on November 30th, where one of the components of that plan for districts to respond to was actually looking at what were they doing to work locally with coalitions and others to help identify students that either were not showing up for VPK or kindergarten, to see how we put those supports and that outreach in place to be responsive. Because we know, you know, based on projections, the kids are here in the state, but we got to figure out how do we build the capacity, again, of the system, but also the confidence of families by showing, you know, the data, the trends, and the safety and health considerations that our providers and our K-12 system have taken to support during this time. But we did see that as a critical element, which is why we made that a very explicit part of emergency order number 7.
Representative Roach, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chairman. So I wanted to take a look back at slide 14, if you can.
Yes, sir.
And that had to do with the early learning for kindergartners. And it looks like, as you mentioned, almost 50% are not ready for kindergarten. And that seems to be data that predates the pandemic. So I wonder if you can talk about how the department was addressing kindergarten readiness prior to the pandemic and now what impact the pandemic has had on kindergarten readiness.
You recognize, Chancellor?
Yes, sir. So I'll start with pre-pandemic and talk a little bit about the work that was there. One of the things that, you know, we've obviously identified through the trends is looking at, you know, also taking into account some of the growth measures and things like that in our formula. As a matter of fact, back in 2019, 100% of the score was based on that first 30-day assessment in Flickers. Then through discussions, we started to look at how do we also take into consideration the growth of a child in VPK from the point they enter a VPK program to the point they complete the VPK program. So we added a growth measure for the first time in that formula back in 2019. Unfortunately, you know, with the termination of some of the assessments and things during that time, the data that we will use at this stage is going to be dependent partially on looking at progress monitoring data, but also we'll be able to continue to look at the progress of our students as they come back into school, which is, you know, again, kindergartners right now are using you know, in our K-12 classrooms, they're using that same Renaissance tool, that STAR literacy assessment, to look at their progress. And we'll be able to pay attention to that a little bit, because it's the first time where we've had this kind of data collection at the state level using the K-12 progress monitoring data that's collected to see how students may be performing now that they are coming into our kindergarten classrooms. Because again, with all the moving, you know, components and with the changes in the assessment protocols, we do have a period of time here that we're going to have to go back and look at what other elements we can use to determine how our students are performing at this time. And so that was part of the $10 million that you saw me show on later in the slide, where we use that out of the K-12 portion of CARES funding to support districts and being able to submit that data so that we can get that into the department, not from an accountability standpoint, but to see what can we glean during this time about how students are performing, and at the same time, what additional supports do we need to consider as we go into this next stage of CARES Act funding to see how we support the system.
Representative Davis, you're recognized for a question. Ranking Member Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I have several. So on slide 11, if you would flip back to that, we received some information last night about the Rising Kindergarten program. So with that, is that, yes. How is the success of this program being measured?
You recognize, Chancellor.
Yes, sir. Part of it is going to be looking at, one, the participation and completion, because part of it goes back to the access. For students that are participating in this program, it was a combination of looking at what was some of the data that we had on children that maybe were not performing during VPK at a level that would trigger a need for additional support, as well as teacher recommendations for participating in this program. So part of it was building the access and working with the districts. Our goal would be is how do we use that progress monitoring data that we're collecting right now in K-12 to see if we can glean from that data and do some matching to see how students are performing in comparison. But our goal, and I think the real, again, success story here is that the 37 districts that are participating, they're able to provide additional access and support to kids that they've identified locally that would benefit from these supports and being able to have that in place. And I think, again, as we continue to look at the data that we're collecting, working hand in hand again with early learning as well as our K-12 system, we'll hopefully have some data that will give us something to kind of learn from and use that to inform next phase strategies with investments going forward.
Follow up, Chair.
You recognize.
Thank you. Could you explain to us how the students are being assessed through their kindergarten year?
You recognize, Chancellor?
Yes, sir. Right now, the districts are using that Renaissance STAR, the STAR Literacy Assessment. So that's being given, and we, because that is a contract that DOE has with the vendor as our statewide Flickers assessment, that is available to the kindergarten students all year, and they're using that as a progress monitoring tool, and then that is data that we're able to collect back to kind of, again, look at the progress and the growth that students are making throughout the year.
Follow up, Chair.
You're going to.
So am I to understand it's being done all year, not in particular intervals, or is it done in particular intervals during the year?
You're recognized.
It would be expected to be done at intervals throughout the year, because what we've done is going back to the emergency orders that we've issued in our K-12 system, and because we're talking about kindergarten, we put in place that they would be submitting, basically in a manner prescribed by the department, progress monitoring data. And so our team is actually collecting that through a system called Bright Bites that helps us to look at the data and be able to analyze that. So it would be at intervals, and most districts are doing it about three times a year, usually first in the first 30 days, sometime mid-year, and then typically sometime before the end of the year.
Two more questions. Thank you, Chair. So you were given funding for this particular program. And so I wanted to know, I'm looking at some of the information that we were given last night, and it looks like you were given $18 million for this particular program, and 34 of the school districts participated. Could you tell us how much money is still left over, or is there any funding left over from the program?
You recognize.
Yes, ma'am. So at this point in time, based on what has been allocated out, based on district application and request to participate in the program, it's a total of 37 districts right now that have applied to be a part of that. And of the funding total, again, 10.9 has been allocated out to those districts to support this initiative. And then overall, in their first round of CARES, you'll notice, I think if you might be referring, I'll just hold it up as a visual, if you're referring to this document, mm-hmm. you'll see in that overall CARES Act package, you'll see where we've actually awarded total across all the different initiatives, a little over $199 million of the $223. And so there are some funds left, but that is where we, again, continue to look at how we would need to allocate, because these are funds that can extend all the way up until September of 2022. So we have to look at how we continue to make, you know, some priorities and decisions, and as we look at the next round of CARES Act funding that will be deployed here once we finalize our plan.
You recognize. Final question.
Thank you, Chair. You brought something else to my attention. So you talked about an overall dollar amount, but in response to the Rising Star Kindergarten program, are those funds that are left over, will they be used for that program? And are we looking at doing that, doing this program again?
Recognize, Chancellor.
So what I would say at this point in time is that what we've allocated based on current applications is kind of where we are. We're at a stage right now where we will be looking at this remaining funding balance that's there, as well as what's going to be coming out of CARES Act 2, and deciding a strategy around the data, the impact, getting feedback from coalitions about local needs. So we will be designing a strategy, and so I don't know if I would say that we're committed to 100%. We're still working through that. We're committed to doing what we think the data tells us we need to do to support children, and so that could very well be part of our next strategy, but we're still in the development stage of thinking about what is the data telling us overall to decide how do we not only use the balance of CARES Act 1, but the additional, you know, I think it's $635 million now that's being allocated out of CARES Act 2, $634 and some change, that is coming through this next phase of CARES that we'll be able to, again, very similarly, set down, design a strategy based on needs and what we see with the system to continue to build that capacity. So we'll have kind of the balance of the 223 and the new pot of funding, and that very well could be a part of the strategy, but I think, again, we will look at the data and see how we continue to support.
Just because you're the ranking member.
So at the end of your presentation, slide 15, would you go back to that for me, please? Just caught my attention. And so my last question to you is, you said 59% of these districts, of 58 districts are below 59%. 58 districts are below 59%. So I'm looking at that, and I want my colleagues to look at this screen. And so my question to you is, as a body, how do we make sure that screen showing the state of Florida is more blue than it is red?
You recognize, Chancellor.
Yes, sir. I think in the end, continuing to support the vision and the goals that we have in place. I think looking at how do we continue to make strategic investments to not only, again, support access by having providers open, but how do we build the capacity of our educators, training our educators in our early learning system, supporting our providers and small businesses that are doing this work to really elevate the overall quality? Because if we can create, you know, conditions through policy, accountability, how do we balance that with the funding that's needed to support families? Those are the conditions that we are hoping to create, not only through the CARES Act funding, but hand in hand with the legislature, the governor, to create this ongoing vision of, again, elevating accountability in conjunction with quality so that we can serve families to get, to your point, more of our counties in the direction that we need, which not only, again, impacts where we get to on the 90%, but you talk about creating those conditions early on for children to hit kindergarten ready and, again, supporting families and the things that they need for their own child. Those are the kind of conditions we want to continue to reinforce.
Representative Lerner, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to direct your attention to slide 13. That's okay.
Yes.
And my question is pretty simple, I think. Is this the percentage of providers that are open currently, and how did providers that went out of business and closed permanently factor into this? Did you lose long-term? Did you lose providers during the pandemic? How does that affect this graph?
You recognize, Chancellor?
Yes, sir. So I have no doubt that we had providers that closed during this process. And that is something that, if it's okay, sir, I'd like to be able to get you maybe some detailed data where we could provide that to you. But this does reflect of the providers right now that are under contract and are providing services to our state. This reflects those that have gone from that 58% closure back in April to where now with, you know, less than almost 1.5%. That have closed. And so I think, again, the capacity is there, but I also want to be clear that while we have providers that are open and we have a large number of providers that have reopened, which again, I think is a result of how we've been intentional about the investments along the way, we still got to continue to look at how do we get the enrollments up so that students are in our programs, taking advantage of the quality that we want to put in place. I think that goes back to the question earlier about how do we pivot more of our counties in the direction that gets to that readiness rate that we need. But I think it's also about how do we you know, navigate and look at some of the shifts that we might see over time. I think we're going to look at, you know, some areas where we have what we refer to as childcare deserts. We have to look at, do we have a need in some areas to bring access to higher quality providers in some areas, or build the capacity of the providers there to get to high quality? But I think to the question that you asked originally, sir, we can get you any additional data with that breakdown if that's acceptable.
Quick follow-up.
Where are you recognized?
A lot of these are small businesses. These are people that are, you know, face-to-face instruction. They're probably at risk for transmission. These are the businesses that we've heard about on the news that have been closing left, right, and center. So I my question is mainly about making sure we support them and we help these providers through this. The follow-up question is mainly about, this isn't the only type of aid and relief that has come for some of these. Like, they also would have been eligible for PPP loans and some of the other small business assistance. So please do follow up with me. The question is really about, what are the other levers of relief for these providers that is helping them through it? What's working, what's not working, and how can we not lose so many small businesses?
You're recognized.
Sir. So I think part of the conversation that we're leading into now is, as we pivot from first round of CARES Act funding into the second CARES Act funding, using data like this, listening to the coalition so that we can keep a strong read on what is it that's happening, that's how we prepare to be responsive in this next round. So that's where, again, I would say here in the near future, when we release what this next plan looks like, again, based on that $634, almost $635 million that we'll be able to redeploy, hopefully that will build some of the capacity that you've expressed. And I can tell you, we hear from coalitions, networks on a regular basis. I've just recently had a conversation with a group that represents a lot of the private providers. And of course, they're navigating not just the impact with school readiness and BPK, but as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, some of them are, you know, have families that are private pay. And when those families are out for 14 days or have challenges, that also creates, you know, some hurdles for those businesses and those families that are part of that business to be able to sustain themselves. So that's the kind of conversations we got to continue to move into as we go into this next phase.
Chancellor Hall, I have a question sort of piggybacking off of Representative Learned. So I agree with you, and I saw it in my own community. We had 80% of our childcare closed in Miami-Dade County at the height of the pandemic, which is, you can imagine the impact that has on our economy and our community. And I think it is a massive win that 98.4% of SR and VPK providers are open. But I would qualify it and say, how many of these providers are barely open? And what I have seen, because you know, I went to a dozen child care centers last week, they are now operating at reduced ratios, primarily because it's hard to socially distance three-year-olds. But understanding that they're operating at reduced ratios from what they were pre-pandemic, and the margins that we have in childcare are so slim that for them to remain open, there needs to be an ongoing conversation about whether it's a look at capacity, which that would be my question to you, is the department looking at anything around capacity? And if not, if the decision is we need to keep ratios at 12-1 now for the foreseeable future, what are we doing to ensure that the 98.4% is actually 98.4% of providers open and thriving and supporting their children and families? And you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. I think you bring up the exact question that we want to continue to navigate. You know, this particular chart, which is updated as of every week now, we do look at the reopening, and we look at what the data is telling us about the capacity of the system. When we look at VPK enrollments last year compared to this year, when we look at, you know, school readiness and where we need to continue to build access. And I will just tell you that I think tracking the data is, again, where we want to be able to stay focused on how does that inform where we need to go in this next round of CARES Act funding, so that, again, we can not only keep them open to that point, but build the capacity and the trust and the faith of our families to bring their children back in, knowing that it's a safe and healthy environment. And those are the efforts that we're going to continue to remain committed to as we move into this next phase.
So members, we have 16 minutes left in committee, and I have Representative Tribolsi, Williams, Cheney, Hawkins, and Nixon. So just keep that in mind. If there's anyone else, just please wave at me. So we will move on to Representative Tribolsi.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for your presentation, Chancellor Hall. It's come to my attention that Florida is set to receive an additional $625 million in child care funding from the COVID relief package passed by Congress. I understand from your presentation that child care providers have been greatly affected by COVID through increased cost in PPP equipment, cleaning supplies, et cetera. These expenses coupled with decreased enrollments have depleted many child care providers' reserve funds.
So soon, providers will also be responsible for implementing the minimum wage increase, which will hit the industry as well. My question is, I would like to know how the department is planning on using this money to support providers who offer high-quality learning opportunities so that there is enough childcare infrastructure to support working families and our economic recovery.
You recognize, Chancellor.
Yes, sir. Representative, I appreciate that question. I would, you know, provide a couple clarifications. Just last night, even, we were anticipating the $625 million. We were actually notified that that is actually $634,960,835. So it's a little bit more than what we were originally projecting, which is, again, that's going to help us serve more families and kids. I think to the point that you bring up about impacts relating to, you know, minimum wage, when we talk about impacts on continuing to build the capacity and getting our children back into our facilities, which does drive the economics of operating our provider networks, twofold. One, yes, using these CARES Act dollars, but I think also we've been very fortunate where we have, you know, $50 million this year to continue to support things like provider rate increases. We have, you know, thanks to the leadership of the governor and his proposed budget, we have that at $100 million next year that we'll be able to use out of the federal trust fund that comes down through things like our CCDF funding at the federal level. These are all things that collectively help us to hopefully strengthen the capacity of our provider networks to address some of those concerns that you bring up while still continuing to, again, invest these dollars strategically while we have them with the CARES Act funding to, again, sustain, grow, get our families, you know, to utilize these services and get their kids back into programs that, again, support not only the family going back to work or continuing their work, but, again, balance that with the quality that we know is necessary to hit the targets that we've addressed as being critical for our children long term.
Okay. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On slide number 11, where you spoke about the pilot program, how was those VPK providers chosen? Is there any preliminary data about the success students or from the beginning or the middle of assessments that's already administered?
You're recognized, Chair, sir.
Thank you, sir. Yes, ma'am. So part of it was actually, it was open for providers to apply that wanted to apply to be a part of the pilot. So it was an invitation for those that wanted to be considered. As it relates to the data, one of the things that we could provide, if it's acceptable, we can make sure that we come back and we can get you a copy of what the data says as we're collecting that. So we're still in the early stages of implementation, but as we're doing that, we could provide you with the data that we have thus far.
And will there be any, will any of the providers be penalized? Because, you know, certain requirements have to be met to be a Gold Star, a VPK provider, because of the students and the enrollment that they are having. Will they be penalized during this period of time?
Recognize, Chancellor.
And if I can ask a clarification, are you referring to the use of the pilot assessment during this time in that whole part of the process? Yes. So the pilot is just that. It is not for accountability purposes. It is really to look at how do we effectively use a tool like that and implement a tool like that, potentially, you know, not only during this time, but are there any lessons learned in using an assessment like that that's aligned directly to the kindergarten entry assessment? Are there some things that we can glean from that data during this period of time?
Representative Cheney, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Learned a lot. Thank you. Have you all learned anything so far that may help you project how your plans and where you will shift funding to once there are vaccines available? And my second question is, what kind of training, I keep hearing we're training the teachers, what kind of training are the educators, what are they getting that they don't get when they get licensed and educated?
You're recognized.
Yes, ma'am. So when we talk about training for our early learning system, we are very fortunate that the Office of Early Learning has a pretty significant library of online training and supports, which during this time obviously are very helpful as we're trying to support, you know, remotely educators in this space. Some of that training helps to look at not only interactions with children, it helps to look at what can they do to support emergent literacy strategies with children in their classroom. And then when we talk about training that goes beyond, you know, our early learning system, we put in $5 million that actually helps us to work very closely around what's called the reading matrix and kind of the science of reading, working closely in our K-12 system with like the reading endorsement support and things there that help our teachers, especially in this case, kindergarten, first, second, and third, know what strategies they need to deploy during this time to, again, not only address growth, but really close gaps at an accelerated rate. So that is some of this two-pronged approach, what we've done in the early learning system to support capacity and training for our early learning educators, but also how we're dovetailing that in our K-12 system with the $5 million we put in place to build the capacity of our teachers, especially those that are maybe working towards a reading endorsement in implementing those effective strategies to build literacy skills.
Representative Hawkins, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Hall, thank you for being here. I appreciate the presentation. I want to reference slide number 7. The number of students from whom there is no test scores appears to be increasing each year at almost 30% in 2018, 2019. Sounds like a lot of students not accounted for in this test, in terms of test scores. I know this may be a little bit off the scope of the slide, but do we know where these children are and why they're not being tested?
You recognize, Chancellor.
It's a great question, sir. So that is actually the result of a few things. One, it could be natural attrition of students leaving the state. It could be students that have transitioned from our K-12 system, maybe going to one of the other choice options available in our state. So there's a number of factors there. You know, some of it could be, you know, students that maybe transitioned and had dropped out or moved into an adult education program, depending on their age at that point in time. So it could be a number of factors, but a lot of that is a result of student attrition once they hit the 10th grade in this particular cohort.
Thank you.
Representative Nixon, you're recognized for a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I have a question, and I'm just for clarity purposes, in regards to the rising kindergarten summer program. Is this? I know that it's the district is overseeing it and things like that, but I'm just wondering. Are they operating it, or are they allowing for contractors, or like how is that working?
You're recognized.
Of the 37 districts, it's essentially they're operating those programs, so they receive the funding. We saw many that would utilize their teachers to come in and provide like a program before kindergarten, you know, class would start at the beginning of the year. And we've seen some that have used some other extended learning opportunities in the fall with teachers to help continue to build the capacity of kindergartners that may have needed that additional support.
Okay.
You recognize for follow-up.
And what is the instructional time look like as it relates to that? I guess I'm asking this question because I'm a mom and just knowing that I'm a working mom and it's a summer program. What about, you know, extended day, that type of thing, and if folks can actually come and pick up their kid and that type of stuff?
You recognize.
With your permission, I'd be happy to get you the flyer that has all that detail, if that's acceptable.
Okay, that's great.
Yep. Yes, ma'am.
That's it.
Representative Hachowski.
Thank you, Chair. I just had a question regarding, I appreciate that you mentioned the 98.4%. The facilities are open, but that just because they're open doesn't mean they have high enrollment. I've spoken to many early learning providers in my community who are struggling because they are open, they provide high quality services, but the children aren't there, and they're wondering going forward how they're going to be able to stay open, and it would be a shame if we were to lose those providers.
You're recognized.
Appreciate that question. Even in this first round of CARES Act funding, we did try to target a combination of providers. We had those that were contracted for services like school readiness, and for those that don't know what school readiness, those are for our children at like the 150% free and, you know, federal poverty level. Our VPK program, which of course is state funded for the 3 hours, you know, of a half day program. And then on the other side of that, you know, we have the providers that again are very dependent on private pay. And our funding model was about trying to do two things. One, support our school readiness and VPK. And then on some levels, we had some of those funds going out to support those that are licensed through DCF based on their size and scope of how many children they would serve through their licensure, so that we could help those that, you know, were high quality providers providing services, but maybe not directly a contracted provider. And I think those are some of the lessons, looking at the data and the trends. We'll use that same information to make informed decisions as we go into this next phase. I think the great news is that while we have this, you know, additional 634, almost 635 million, it's important to also point out that we've got that for at least a little more than a 2-year period. So we have to stretch those dollars as far as we can. It's not like that's money that's coming in right now for just a year. That's something we need to stretch for the next couple years as we continue to follow the trends. But definitely agree with you, and we've heard, you know, very similar things from the networks and the providers that have been in touch with us and continue to keep us informed about what those local barriers and challenges are.
Representative Tribolsi, you recognize?
Thank you, Chair, for a round two question. The presentation states gave grants to providers who serve VPK and school readiness providers and other non-contracted providers. However, if you add all of those funds and divide by the number of providers who received the funds, assuming a provider received every round of funding, they received approximately $15,000. That amounts to the cost of the tuition, child care for two children. This is not enough to sustain business operations for 9 months if it was to be used for all those activities, especially considering many providers had decreased enrollment during this time, but still had to pay hard costs, such as building utilities. Can you comment to that, please?
Yes, ma'am. I think in the end, you know, the investments and the things that we tried to do in each one of these phases, it was trying to be responsive to the conditions at that point in time. Again, recognizing that we have, you know, over 11,000 providers across the state, you know, it's a lot of providers, and we have to figure out how to divvy up and really align funding and investments to support as many of the providers as possible. Again, do we anticipate and expect to obviously continue to do more to support our programs in that circumstance? I think, again, knowing that we at least, again, we've got a system now that has access. Now we've got to continue to look at how do we go from a foundation and these building blocks of having a system at 98%, you know, open to now let's get more and more families and children served by those programs. And so this will be, again, I think this is the kind of data, the point that you bring up, how do we use this next round of funding to continue to address those needs and concerns that you mentioned and identify?
So, Chancellor, we have 4 more minutes. I'm gonna ask one fairly high-level question and to just keep track of time, and we can have a longer conversation afterward. Yes, but I think it's so important that we had Representative Tribolsi's bill today around literacy. And third grade reading is this central data point that is so important to everything that we do as a state. And you know, what I look at that chart, and I'm so grateful for the speaker's leadership on this, identifying the number of children who are not ready for kindergarten. And you know as well as I do that if a child is not ready for kindergarten, it is very, very difficult to catch them up. And the vast preponderance of those children are not going to be reading at grade level by third grade. So we are a state that has 53% of our children who are, quote, ready for kindergarten. And you know my concerns about the Flickr's assessment and how it's used. But with that being said, let's assume for the sake of argument that half of our students are ready. It means half of our students are not. What have we not done in Florida? Actually, why are half of our students not ready for kindergarten? Because you and I are both looking at the 2030 workforce. We're looking at the students going into public, into the university system in 2030. How are we ensuring that 8 years from now, children who aren't born yet are coming into kindergarten, coming into third grade, ready and prepared?
Yes, sir. I think it's a combination of factors. It can't be one single initiative or one single thing that's going to change all those conditions. I think it's collectively building up the quality of our child care centers to, again, focus, and I've heard you mention this many times as well, how do we support children, you know, from birth up to age 3 and 4? How do we support them in those critical skills about access and being exposed to words and vocabulary, and what are the environments that are helping to build that social and emotional development and the brain development that prepares them for our VPK programs? It starts to make that shift a little bit more into an instructional and getting ready for those skills that they're gonna hit in kindergarten. So I think it across the board, we have to continue to balance, again, accountability and accountability helping to drive quality. And if we can do that in a way that helps to address some of these other challenges that we know that we got to continue to navigate with, you know, provider rate increases and doing things that are going to really support our networks out there to do the quality that we're asking for. We do those things collectively, and then we have students ready, to your point, at kindergarten coming in with those skills. Our teachers then in K-3, they will continue to lead, and we're going to continue to build on this work because the investments that we've made at least for the next 2 years through the first round of CARES dollars with our regional literacy directors, with the curriculum, the training for our teachers, we put those things collectively in place. I think we're going to have, a system with conditions that are going to seed right up front the work that we have to do and continue to build on, and we'll have the evidence and data to drive that.
Chancellor Hall, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I know how much you care about these issues, and I know how hard you've worked in your role as chancellor. So thank you for being with us.
I appreciate it.
Members, I would just offer this. I mentioned the third grade reading score, and just to put that into perspective for all of us, the children who are sitting in our third grade classrooms today, those will be the children who will be going into our state college, our state university system, or into the workforce in 2030. And those students who are coming into third grade in 2030, they're going to be born next year. So there is an opportunity for us to get a lot of these pieces right to ensure that the future of Florida is very bright. And again, I'm truly grateful to be on this committee with all of you. So with that, members, Representative Fetterhoff moves re-rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.